Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In section two of his essay, The Will to Believe, William James is going to engage in some criticism of another earlier philosopher's argument for the existence of God. And it's called Pascal's Wager after Blaise Pascal, the great mathematician, philosopher, and would-be theologian. It's found in Pascal's Pensées, which were a set of notes that he had accumulated as he was attempting to write a great work of apologetics. So it comes from a section called, in French, Le Pari, or The Wager. And Pascal is arguing that if we're betting people, then we ought to embrace, at least on a pragmatic level, the idea that God exists, and we ought to act accordingly, that it's actually a rational decision to make the intellect, you might say, conform to the will and to eventually work ourselves into belief by engaging in a certain mode of action. Interestingly, James himself in this essay, The Will to Believe, is taken by many interpreters as providing yet another pragmatic style of argument. James is, in fact, a pragmatist. He's one of the people who embraced that term. And so both he and Pascal are doing somewhat similar things, both based on action and its relationship with belief. So why is James criticizing Pascal's wager? First, we have to go over what Pascal's wager actually amounted to. And this is not the totality of that section in his work, the Pensées or the Thoughts, but it's a close enough approximation for this. So Pascal's wager you can think of as presenting something like a square of possible options and outcomes. And there's two sides to each of these, or two possibilities. One of these is a factual possibility. Either God exists or God does not exist. One of those is true. There's really no halfway house in between existence when it comes to things like that. So, you know, you could say, well, it exists in what way or what kind of God? We're not going to worry about that at this point. Here's what the human person, the believer or non-believer, has up to them. They can act as if God exists, or they can act as if God doesn't exist. So what are the possible outcomes in this 2x2 grid? So let's think about if you act, first of all, let's take the God doesn't exist, right? If God doesn't exist and you act as if God does exist, then you're probably missing out on some pleasures. You know, you don't get to sleep in on Sunday mornings, or, you know, whenever it happens to be that you go to church, or whatever would be the ceremony. And there's some moral rules that you have to follow. Think about those in the Ten Commandments. Don't steal, don't commit adultery, you know, but stealing is sometimes profitable and committing adultery can be fun. Don't kill, don't bear false witness, all those sorts of things, right? Well, you know, you would be doing those and you're missing out on some good times as a result. But you're not missing out on that much because, you know, human life is finite. So even if you were able to, like, heap up your pleasures, you're not actually losing too much. Same thing with act as if God doesn't exist. If God doesn't exist, oh, you get to enjoy yourself and then you die. So you're not beset by the same problems as religious believers who are willfully depriving themselves of some of the pleasures they could be enjoying, but you're still not getting that much more than they are. Then what if God does exist? Well, now we have an infinite reward or punishment, an infinite good or an infinite evil. Because, you know, according to Christian doctrine, you're either going to ultimately to heaven, in which case you'll enjoy eternal beatitude, that is happiness and bliss, or you're going to hell, in which case you suffer infinite death, eternal death, torment, whatever that happens to be. And you don't have to have a clear conception of it. Whatever it happens to be, it's pretty bad, right? As a matter of fact, infinitely bad. So whatever good stuff you get as a compensation, like the pleasures you enjoy in this life, far outweighed by the infinite evil. And the compensation for missing out on those pleasures that you otherwise could have indulged yourself in this life, is infinite payoff. Beyond pleasure, it's bliss. Now, Pascal says, if you are a rational better, you don't know whether God exists or doesn't exist. You don't know where the ball's going to fall on the roulette table, although the ball has already fallen, so to speak, right? The cards have already been dealt. You just are going to find out whether you pick the right or wrong side. What's the right side to pick? For Pascal, it's definitely act as if God exists, because you don't want to take the chance of that infinite torment. You don't want to take the chance of losing out on that infinite good just for the sake of some finite pleasures. Now, Pascal says something that James is going to pick up on that allows some criticisms to be made. There are other ways to criticize this argument as well. One would be, well, you know, which God are you talking about? For Pascal, though, it has to do with the actions. What do you do if you act as if God exists? He says, well, you take the holy water and go to Mass, and, you know, eventually it'll sort itself out, right? So you bless yourself with holy water when you walk in, or things along those lines. And you would presumably partake in all of the rituals appropriate to not just a Christian, but a Catholic way of acting as if God exists. So James has three main criticisms of Pascal's wager here. He says that you probably feel that when religious faith expresses itself like this, in the language of the gaming table, it's put to its last trumps. Surely, Pascal's own personal belief in masses and holy water had far other springs, and this celebrated page of his is but an argument for others, a last desperate snatch at a weapon against the hardness of the unbelieving heart. We feel that a faith in masses and holy water adopted willfully, and et cetera, et cetera. He's saying that Pascal has some other passional or volitional sources for why he thinks that masses and holy water, as opposed to Hindu bhakti, as opposed to a plain song or something like that, as opposed to sitting silently in Quaker meeting until somebody is, you know, inspired to speak, or whatever other thing it would be, Pascal has some other attachment to this. And that's going to lead ultimately to the third criticism. But the second criticism is this, and there's actually a nice funny joke in there. He says, we feel a faith in masses and holy water adopted willfully after such a mechanical calculation would lack the inner soul of a faith's reality. And then he goes a little bit further. I think this is funny myself, but in some respect, it actually shows that none of us should be God. He says, if we were ourselves in the place of the deity, we should probably take particular pleasure in cutting off believers of this pattern from their infinite reward. In other words, if you're only believing in God because you're looking for the payoff, maybe you don't deserve the payoff then. Maybe you're just like, as Anselm said in one of his treatises, the De Similitudinibus, people like that are basically mercenaries, right? Would a truly infinite and good God cut such people off? Maybe not. Would we? Yes, because we think that there's something repugnant about making your belief a set of payoffs on a matrix. The third criticism that James is going to make is particularly interesting, and it connects us back to this essay and to this notion about options. He says that it's evident, unless there is some pre-existing tendency, which he thinks that Pascal has, to believe in masses and holy water, the option offered to the will by Pascal is not a living option. So he says, certainly no Turk, by this he means a Muslim, ever took to masses and holy water on its account, and even to us Protestants these means of salvation seem such foregone impossibilities that Pascal's logic, invoked for them especially, leaves us unmoved. As well might the Mahdi write to us saying, I am the expected one whom God has created in his effulgence. You shall be infinitely happy if you confess me, otherwise you'll be cut off from the light of the sun. Weigh then your infinite gain if I am genuine against your finite sacrifice, if I am not. His logic would be that of Pascal, but he would vainly use it on us. Why? The hypothesis he offers us is dead. No tendency to act on it exists to any degree. And so, you know, we might say, well, the world is divided up then into those who can accept masses and holy water and those who can't. They're the Catholics, perhaps the Orthodox as well, and Oriental Orthodox, and then everybody else, that's not going to work for them. But even among Catholics, that might not work either. If your only experience with masses is it's this place that everybody goes to mumble songs along and kneel and stand up at the right time, and every once in a while, towards the end, you get a wafer and a little bit of a drink, and you have no conception of what's actually going on, probably not going to be a live option, right? There has to be something there in order to give that weight. So this isn't a proof in the sense that Pascal means it to be. That's James' criticism, because it's got no, you could say, gripping points in our hearts or our passional and volitional nature, whereas it did for Pascal and it did for most of the other people that he is writing to in his own time, but no longer works in the present the way that Pascal intended it to do. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.